Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right, welcome back, folks. And it's now or never. Don't forget that that debt that you look at on the national debt clock is fraud. And as I promised on Friday, that we were going to have Tammy Young get back with us. And so instead of having Paul Venable, you know, learn, because I think Paul Venable has learned so much that his head exploded or it's just can't wear his hats anymore. So we're going to have that same problem with Tammy here, because, as you know, we've had Tammy already on board and we already started the resolutions. And so Tammy will get back into that, but we do have a curriculum. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you, because it really does help when somebody, you know, does the reading, because you're going to read this stuff for the first time. You're going to go, what the heck? And it's one, hopefully it helps when you read. And go ahead and take your time reading, because I want you to kind of absorb this. And you probably even read some of this stuff beforehand. But what this curriculum is we kind of start off in January with the Tory Acts, because the Tory Acts is the point in time when our forefathers, those independent Englishmen in the colonies, started waking up to the tyranny that they were facing in the colonies from Britain. And so they started organizing themselves, and as they organized themselves, they finally came to the conclusion that they needed to unite to basically demand Britain recognize these colonies as, you know, English colonies, that these people were Englishmen and they had rights. They wanted, you know, representation. You're going to tax us? We want representation. These fundamental things. And so the Tory Acts is literally the beginning of us getting organized. We go through the Articles of Association. We went through the Articles of Confederation. We went through, you know, those historical things. And then we dove into the ratification debates. And we've just wrapped the ratification debates up. So now we're going to kind of take it from the ratification debates on. And usually we hit the Assumption Act, but in my discovery, because this is really important, because it's post-ratification debate, and so this is where the content needs to come in, yet I don't have it nice and clean to present. So what I want to do is I want to present to you and to the audience exactly how things started shaping as the Constitution was ratified. Now, the Constitution was literally ratified by the parameters in the Constitution by New Hampshire, and that was June 21st, 1788. Hamilton and Jefferson were sending letters back and forth, and as a matter of fact, come to find out, Hamilton, being the maniacal little creature that he was, and I know I'm being hard on him, but, you know, he did these things. And everybody has, you know, there's way too many people that put him on a pedestal that he was a great man and he really helped this nation. He actually opened, he put breaches in the barriers that were supposed to actually be instituted through the Constitution. And he helped the judiciary be the culpable branch in actually breaching the Constitution to where we're in the situation we are today. And so Hamilton was sending these, as a matter of fact, during the ratification debates at the very beginning, Madison, Jay, and Hamilton were in New York and they were writing the Federalist Papers. And the Federalist Papers were literally selling the I'll call it the strong points. They were helping people understand this Constitution and why it was such an advantage. In other words, they were being pretty honest at that point in time. Now, at the end of March, or around March time frame, actually, I think it was the beginning of March, it was the time when Madison actually stopped contributing to the Federalist Papers. He got on his horse. He had to ride all the way back down to Virginia so that he could run a campaign to basically be a delegate at the Virginia ratification debates. And so while he was down in Virginia, him and Hamilton started writing again. Hamilton at this point, and you got to remember Hamilton, if you don't know this, most people don't, but remember this. Hamilton had an incredible network of connections. He was Washington's right-hand man for almost the majority of the Revolutionary War. When these two finally met after Washington came down from Massachusetts, I think it was somewhere in there, which was the beginning of 1776, Hamilton came along and became his aide. He was the aide to the general. And so Hamilton stepped into that job, and he started managing, and Washington just loved how he managed the affairs and helped, you know, keep all the balls in the air that Washington needed. So he was very integral in Washington's successes that, you know, and in the process, he was meeting all these people. So he started knowing, you know, all of the leaders within the Continental Army. He started knowing all the officers, because it's not that it wasn't big. It was a long war, and there were lots of breaks and so forth. So he became very intimate with a lot of officers. One officer that he met, that he became very intimate with, was John Marshall. John Marshall was a young kid, and John Marshall wasn't as learned as Hamilton. Now, Hamilton, in Washington's eyes, was the most literate man in all of America. He was absolutely amazed at how well and how well read he was. And so Washington kind of had this favor towards Hamilton towards the end of the war. He didn't even want to really let Hamilton go. Hamilton had to have a hissy fit and kind of went Karen on him, if you know what I mean. And so Washington goes, you know what, you're right. Because Hamilton's position was, you know, I've been your aide this whole time, and I know I've been a good aide for you, but I have a right to, you know, earn my ranks as an officer out in fighting the war. Now, this really seemed like Hamilton was taking this real position that he wanted to get into the real action of the war, but this was really happening towards the end of the war. In other words, where there was far less risk to Hamilton being under fire and so forth. The army by this point in time had really galvanized, and it was doing, you know, very well. And so as we were kind of marching towards the end of the war, Hamilton has, you know, now I want to go get this credit in George Washington's eyes that I'm a hero too. And so he played Washington like a fiddle. Like a what do you call those children? A prodigy. I mean, Hamilton was a prodigy in playing people, and I say this because when they went into the ratification debates, and getting back to the story where Hamilton was writing Madison, Hamilton was also writing a contact that he had, and I don't know who it was, and I don't even know this for sure, but nine times out of ten, when, you know, I start discovering things, these, you know, it only becomes logical that Hamilton was playing lots of people in the different states to keep track of whether the Constitution was being ratified. Once it seemed like it was getting ratified after, you know, the first few states, I think Hamilton was, you know, getting, you know, like a little kid, kind of giddy. Oh, this is really happening. This is really going to happen. And I think he realized that there were some things that he needed to do to punch a hole in the Constitution. So when Madison and him started writing, he was very interested in trying to create an advantage so that he could actually enter into the Federalist Papers after it was dead. And I'll explain in just a minute here. But what we have here is this communication network that was being created by Hamilton with Madison. And Madison didn't know this. And so in, and I want to say this was probably, let me see, this was June 8th, right before the Virginia ratification debates really kicked in. So I'm just going to read this one little segment out of a letter Hamilton sent to Madison. And this was basically telling Madison that as soon as he got favorable news that they were going to ratify, because they knew it took days, right? So any type of communication took days to, you know, to get. And he knew that New York would be in the heat of their ratification debates while Madison was, you know, in his. And so this is what he's communicated in this letter. He says, to communicate to me by express. Now, express means like the Pony Express. He actually, you know, because back in those days, the Pony Express really, this was kind of like the beginning concept of technically the franchise, the Pony Express. So to communicate to me by express the event of any decisive question in favor of the Constitution authorizing changes of horses. So in other words, give me as soon as you can the favorable disposition that you're ratifying, if that happens. And if so, then he says, in favor of the Constitution, then he says this, authorizing changes of horses and et cetera with an assurance. So in other words, he's telling this, you know, Madison to hire somebody that can do express pony service so that, you know, and authorize as many changes as necessary so that this person being sent can get to him as fast as possible. And then this is what he says, with an assurance to the person sent that he will be liberally paid for his diligence. Now, this is Colonel Hamilton, right? And everybody kind of knows Colonel Hamilton. This is before the Constitution and everything else had happened. So his prominence was, you know, this war hero under Washington. And so he was kind of in Washington's shadow. And so Madison basically followed what he wanted. And the question is, where was Hamilton getting all this money to be able to pay for these things? Because he was not that affluent and he wasn't that successful as a lawyer. And so there have been innuendos, and I'm beginning to believe that the innuendos are true. I have no hard evidence, but I'm just going to put it out there that I've received from McKibbins a document that came from Canada that identified Hamilton as the number 7 spy in the United States. You didn't know that, did you?
Wow.
Yeah. So this is why there's merit to this. Okay, so this is all going on. Hamilton is watching. Now, what I'm going to do, and folks, what I'm going to share with Tammy, because she'll be able to see this, you won't, but you can go to theconstitutionsociety.org, and down in the constitutional website, let me get to where I'm at. If I go backwards, down in the Constitutional Society website, there are these drop-down menus, and you want to click on Constitution, and then, of course, and then when you do that, and actually I need to go back again because there's these drop-downs, and when you click on Constitution, just put your mouse over it, and it'll have this little table. And where do you want to go next? You want to click on the Federalist Papers. You want to view this on the Constitution Society because I'm going to prove my point here. Click on the Federalist Papers, and then, and I'm kind of blowing it up for Tammy's benefit, when we look at the dates of the Federalist Papers, you can see where Madison wrote his last comment in the Federalist Papers, and that was, excuse me, March 1st. And then you see John Jay wrote one on the Senate. And then Hamilton wrote the remainder going through March, and everything that he was speaking of and the titles. So Tammy's going to see me do this. If you actually do a search on the page and you look for judiciary, you'll actually find that there are only 7 instances of the word judiciary. So in other words, the Federalist Papers may have touched a little bit on the judiciary, but there were no titles, no specific papers that were focused on the judiciary. You seeing this, Tammy?
Yep. Okay. I see it.
Okay. So when is the first article? Because it gives you the date and then the day right here. When was this first article regarding the judiciary written by Hamilton?
It was June 14th.
June 14th, friends. And so the Federalist paper that pretty much ended the Federalist Papers for for the reading enjoyment of the audience watching this Constitution move forward was April 2nd. So in other words, that was over a month and a half, or basically it was a month and a half, no Federalist Papers. All of a sudden, Hamilton had this inspiration that he was going to write a Federalist paper on the judiciary, the Judiciary Department. Folks, June 14th was when he started getting positive news that it looked like New Hampshire was going to ratify. And as a matter of fact, if you go to the New Hampshire ratification debates, they did not ratify. And as a matter of fact, I will pull this up because this is important. I'm showing Tammy the evidence of this supposition, what I'm purporting. And what I'm basically saying is that Hamilton played America. Now, I've got all my debates right here. And we didn't cover New Hampshire. There's the New Hampshire debate. And so many of the debates were not challenged to debates. In other words, they convened and they kind of discussed quickly. And so when they convened was, I forget, as a matter of fact, I'll have to go look at the day they actually got together. But they did the final ratification on the 21st. And so I believe when they first convened at the very beginning, the way the debate was going to go down, it would look like it was going to be a rubber stamp. So they had these discussions, and they met usually for a week or two, like Delaware. I mean, Delaware met for about a week, but they rubber stamped it. They were the first state to ratify the Constitution with a rubber stamp. And it looked like what was playing out of New Hampshire was a rubber stamp convention. So Hamilton recognized that the Constitution had been ratified. In other words, we had a ratification that was going to be a rubber stamp. There was going to be no vigorous debate. And you see here where they're kind of going through and they're just adding amendments. So in other words, all they were doing was convening to meet and work through an agreeable amendments. You seeing this, Tammy? I mean, this is not yes. like your typical debates. It's only 3 pages. If I pull up, and I'm going to, because I just want, because Tammy hasn't seen these before, I'm going to pull up the Virginia debates. And when I look at the Virginia debates and we look at how many pages, there are 306 pages instead of 3.
Oh, wow.
In other words, Virginia vigorously debated the Constitution. And so we can go to New York as well, because we didn't cover New York this year in the details, but New York was another one that was vigorously debated. And the point here is Hamilton, being maniacal as he is, he knew the sentiments of New York. And so New York's debates went 141 pages. I also have already told the audience, you didn't know this, Tammy, but for your benefit, Hamilton's vigor, Hamilton's assertions were very weak-kneed. In other words, when he was making assertions about what was happening, you know, regarding the debates themselves. In other words, as you know, just kind of keeping an eye on the clock, we got about 4 minutes, so let me finish this story. So as Hamilton was basically addressing the challenges of the Constitution by some of the New York anti-federalists, there was a very strong movement of anti-federalists in New York, and they wanted to kill this thing called the Constitution. And so, but Hamilton knew that if Virginia ratified, it was done. New York would have to join the Union, because they weren't going to join the Union, you know, they weren't going to be out of the Union with Virginia in, because these were the two big commerce states. Virginia and New York and Massachusetts were the three. And Massachusetts, well, Pennsylvania was a pretty decent state, and same with North Carolina. But the three, you know, monsters was Massachusetts, New York, and Virginia. Massachusetts was in. If Virginia went in, Hamilton knew, as a strategic thinker, he knew that New York would have to ratify. So he was biding his time. And so that's why when people said all of these, you know, insinuations, he was not nearly as bold as to what the way he framed his words in the Federalist Papers was like an absolute. You know, no, this is this, and no, they, you know, they, that can't happen. They got to do this. It's enumerated. And he was very strong in his wording in the Federalist Papers. He was weak-kneed, and he spoke a lot of theoretical stuff in the ratification debates. He did this because he was just buying time. He knew that Virginia would conclude well before they would, and he was going to get the word from Madison whether they ratified or not, because then they would know. And so then it would have been a done deal. So going back to these letters, as we look at these letters, he started his maniacal plan June 4th. And so as we, that means that we don't have Tammy here. Well, it sounds like she's back. But anyway, let me keep going here. June 18th is when he went into the next one, and that's when he knew New Hampshire did and was going to ratify. Then on June 21st, when he had official confirmation.
Oh.
Yeah, it's okay. I knew you left. So I kept talking. So anyway, so yes, I can. So anyway, as we kind of go down this path of Hamilton writing these letters, or I should say he was writing letters to Madison back and forth. They continued communicating. He started this attack by using the judiciary, and it was in Federalist Papers 80, 81, and 82, I believe, and I'm going to open them up so that Tammy can see these things, because when you look at the Federalist Papers, and I've got them right. Where are they? Where are the F papers? So, oh, they're all the way up at the top. I'm sorry, folks. So when we look at the Federalist Papers themselves, and then we look at interpretation, see, folks, the judiciary has been granted, or basically what Hamilton basically said was that the judiciary would be able to interpret the law. Now, that was never mentioned in any of the ratification debates, not once, not in Virginia, not even in New York, did Hamilton say that the judges would be able to interpret the law. Where did that come from? When we look at, let me see here, interpretation, I-N-T-E-R-P-R-E, and then you, because I'm looking in the ratification debates, and you find 32 matches of interpose with interpretation, E-R, and folks, I hate doing this, E-R-P-R-E-T, interpret. So there's 17 matches on the word interpret. So interpretation, interpret, what have you. 17. And as we look through this, and as a matter of fact, that's the music, we're going into break. So Tammy, if you can hang on, we'll pick you up after the break. And folks, what I'll do is I'm going to close on this so I can prove to you exactly how Hamilton handed over the Constitution to the judiciary to start shredding. So folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so where were we? So we were just kind of wrapping up this story of how Hamilton started basically injecting the word interpret into the Judiciary Federalist Papers. And so let me kind of dive into this a little bit more, because when we look at the Federalist Papers that contain in the interpretation, so I'm kind of showing this to Tammy, you can actually see that in Federalist Paper 80, towards the very end, the interpretation, the necessity of uniformity in the interpretation of the national laws, this is where he's setting the stage at the very end of 80. Now, we're talking about several pages that he added. These are big, meaty pieces. I think the precursor to this, the last one, was like maybe a 3-page Federalist paper, the last one that he did in April. So all of a sudden, the spigot turns on, and the focus is on the judiciary and the injection of interpretation. And so 80, when did he write 80? Tammy?
Oh, I actually cannot see your screen right now.
Oh, you cannot see the screen. I'm sorry. So I will tell you what it is, and then you can actually, you know, see, oh, okay, yeah, GR's not kidding. He wrote...
Okay, there, I can see it now.
So he wrote this on June 21st. The day the Constitution was formally ratified, he already had the drop on it, he published this article that actually opened the door with interpretation and the necessity of having a uniform interpretation of the national laws. And that the judges, when they couldn't figure out what to do, they would interpret. So what ended up happening, folks, is that the ratification debates were completely obscured by the judiciary. That wasn't by accident. That was by design, because Hamilton knew that if the jurists could actually just come along and say, well, we can interpret the law. This was a theory, and this was an applied theory in Britain and other places of how that was. Why is it different in America? Because the Constitution in Article 3 limited the judiciary to basically judge cases based upon fact and law. They were not given the ability to use case law, precedents, or interpretation, nor could they make law. This is one of the reasons why John Jay, who was the first Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Jay, he was asked to step down so that he could lead the treaty negotiations with Spain over, the treaty negotiations with Spain over the navigation of the Mississippi and working out that treaty. And so Jay stepped down, and then when he came back, and that became a dismal failure, and so he kind of had his bruises and lumps and bumps because the nation was just, you know, excoriating him. After that kind of settled down, Washington basically said, would you like to go back to the judiciary to be the Supreme Court justice? And at that point, Jay said no, because having sat on the bench, it's really a do-nothing job. We, you know, we basically only judge whether it's in the Constitution or not. I mean, we don't create law. There's very little for us to do. I said, you know, I just feel guilty taking money for what we're supposed to do. We're so tightly controlled. Well, when Adams became the president of the United States, and actually the Chief Justice went, I think, to two other people, something like Rutledge and Oliver or something like that. Nevertheless, I do have it right here. So it went to John Rutledge that replaced Jay. And then when he was going to step down in 1795, Oliver basically took over in 1796. And this is when Washington asked Jay, would you like to go back instead of me putting Oliver in, Oliver Ellsworth? And he said, no, it's a do-nothing job. So Oliver Ellsworth was in there, and he resigned December 15th in 1800. Who was president in 1800? John Adams. And what little maniacal creature had the ear of John Adams? And this was literally because what was happening in December of 1800 was the outcome of an election that actually shocked John Adams, or the beginning of the outcome, because I think it went into January on the Electoral College, but John Adams knew by this point in time he was out, and they didn't know who was going to be the president, I believe, because it was kind of this long out, you know, compromise politics and so forth. It did, the determination of the president was not a one-day deal, which is why we have the 12th Amendment. And as a matter of fact, a part of that ordeal was the fact that we were looking at this thing called the Aaron Burr potential presidency. And so when Aaron Burr almost made it to the presidency because of the way they were casting ballots, this became a real need for the 12th Amendment. Anyway, as we look at what is happening with John Adams and the reality that he's stepping out, this little maniacal creature starts whispering in Adams' ear, the best thing you can do is you can actually plant a whole bunch of judiciaries that will tie down Jefferson. Because Jefferson and Hamilton were at odds. I tell you, it wasn't a term of endearment when Jefferson referred to Hamilton as the creature. And so, so Hamilton basically convinced John Adams to insert John Marshall as the next Chief Justice. Now, if you want proof of this, Russell Kirk, in his book, The Conservative Mind, identified how Marshall, because everybody looked at Marshall as a conservative, but actually Russell Kirk points out that Marshall was one of the first to actually start taking whacks at the Constitution using the bench. And he points to how Hamilton was his mentor. John Marshall was a protege of Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton rose to this prominence as, you know, even though he never made it to general, he was Colonel Hamilton, and he basically had Washington's ear. And when Washington died, he became one of the most prominent men in America. The only other prominent men that he had to basically deal with was Jefferson and Madison, the father of the Constitution and the father of the Declaration of Independence. And so when we get into the resolutions, we'll actually prove how what they did in 1798 into 1799, beginning in 1800, in trying to get the states to do what was necessary. These two men, these superheroes, actually pulled off a coup of the unseating of Adams and the removal, the beginning of the removal of Federalists from office. And Hamilton basically, Hamilton and Adams were defeated by these two guys. And this is why Hamilton basically went to Adams while he was licking his wounds, knowing that he wasn't going to become the next president, or he wasn't going to get his second term. And this created a huge schism between Adams and Jefferson. And so much, I mean, these guys were close friends when they were emissaries over in France and in Europe. They worked together on the treaty to end the Revolutionary War in London. So, I mean, these guys had history. And so, but Hamilton actually convinced Adams to do these nefarious things. And so John Marshall was the one, and I'm convinced of this, but I don't have any evidence yet, but I'm going to get it. It was John Marshall that basically said, we're not going to have anything to do with the ratification debates. We're going to use the Federalist Papers as our principal guide of guiding us legally, because it had these new insertions on, you know, based on the grace of Hamilton. These new insertions at the end of the Federalist Papers on the judiciary, where nobody even listened to or even cared about the Federalist Papers. What he was publishing was his future, basically, breach of the Constitution. If he could get the judiciary to use these as the guide, then down the road they could start interpreting and they could ingratiate themselves and aggrandize the power of the judiciary. Folks, who rules us today? Remember that old saying. There's that old saying, and I think it was Voltaire that they gave credit to. But I believe when you look at that, you know, that saying, what is it? If you want to know who rules over you, just look for who you are not allowed to criticize. And so yeah, the judiciary is one of those that they don't take kind. I mean, if you ever criticize them and you come before them, they will humble you pretty quickly. We actually have a judiciary that's creating laws and driving this nation down, have been driving this nation for centuries down the wrong path. So the fact is what Hamilton was doing, he knew it would actually help create a stronger, more centralized power, but with the fact that Jefferson and Madison stepped in, you know, the nation was kind of put on pause because they weren't going to have it. Now, there were things that were happening in the judiciary that Marshall was pushing forward on, and one of those things that started happening that never happened before was these things called opinions. Marshall was the one that aggrandized the court in making opinions. And in his opinions, which meant nothing, the only thing that matters coming from a case out of the Supreme Court is the ruling. The opinion of why he ruled that way was basically made so that he could create the footings by making assertions that were wrong. In other words, in the Maryland v. McCullough, if I remember correctly, it was a necessary and proper issue that he used in his ruling. He injected this necessary and proper and supremacy clause that he said that, you know, the federal government is supreme in all things. This is where he started planting these footings that down the road, when judges started using case law and precedents, that didn't happen until the 1830s. So in other words, Marshall actually died, or he left the court about the same time as when they started injecting case law and precedents. That happened, I believe it was in 1835 or 1837, something like that. And that was right when Madison was dying. Now, why didn't Madison say something about these opinions where he actually started stretching and redefining these clauses in his opinions? Why? Because they had no weight. It just made Marshall feel better, and Madison kind of chuckled and says, you know, the babblings of a madman. Well, they came back to bite us because as the courts started looking and leaning on Marshall and what he said in his rulings, they used those to help interpret, oh, well, because he said this, then we can do that. And that is how Hamilton, with the interpretations, as well as setting us to go down the path into case law, which basically is when they injected civil law into our legal system. We're supposed to have common law at the states, and the federal government only basically dealt with the state's common law, and then they had admiralty law and international law and those types of laws with their foreign affairs. That was it. They started truly perverting our system at the hands of Hamilton and his protege, John Marshall. And it all happened right there at the end of the Federalist Papers when the Constitution and everything that the Federalist Papers said, you know, had no legal standing. As a matter of fact, as we move forward, and we can now start to move forward, which is, you know, why you're here, Tammy. As we move forward, we're going to actually hit documents where Madison literally cites the ratification debates in his arguments. He's basically creating the contract context. In other words, hey, this compact was justified in these debates by stating specifically that they could only do those things enumerated. And this actually came in at a very early point. The point that this came in was actually in the second year of the first session of Congress. In 1789, when Congress met, the very first thing that they did was they actually created these acts. And these acts, the first acts of Congress, were basically what we could look at to say what was the most important thing that Congress thought they needed to take and nail down. The very first act, and if I send it to you, Tammy, if you get a chance to read it, you'll actually confirm this, that the very first act that Congress did in establishing a statute and law in pursuant to the Constitution was the act of administering the oath of office. So if somebody was going to say, well, what was the most important thing for Congress to deal with when this new government formed? That is it. So in other words, folks, they knew how important the oath of office really was and how holding public servants legally accountable to this requirement of stating an oath to support the Constitution over all other things became, second to none, which is why down the road, the 14th Amendment with Section 3 and the putting teeth into that accountability really became a prominent factor for us as the people in holding our public servants accountable by using petitions and then saying, hey, if you don't support the Constitution, you are ineligible to be in office because that's what Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does. So I'm trying to connect all the dots here. So as we kind of move forward, in 1790, Hamilton starts his work in attacking the Constitution. And what he does is he says, oh, well, there are implied powers. And we're actually going to go through the debates and everything else. But the very first act that Hamilton created, and we cover this every year, is the Assumption Act. And the Assumption Act was this act of financing this thing called the debt. In other words, financing the state's debt by assuming their debts and saying, we're going to pay this debt for you. Now, this debt is the war debt that the states had. There were a few states that actually paid their debt or almost completely paid their debt. And so the states that didn't pay their debt got a huge advantage because they weren't paying it. Now the federal government was stepping in and saying, we're going to assume your debt. And so you don't have to worry about paying that. Well, what a slap in the face to all of those states that actually paid their debt, right?
Yeah, kind of like student loan debt.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, absolutely. So What ends up happening, sorry, I got a frog here. What ends up happening is Hamilton is looking at a sure defeat. Sure defeat that Madison is not going to let the Assumption Act move forward. Now, Jefferson, not knowing this maniacal little Colonel Hamilton, never met the guy. And as a matter of fact, he wasn't impressed with what he did because it took, I think, 2-3 months before Jefferson finally was seated as the Secretary of State. That was the very first prominent position, you know, out of the three positions. I think they actually had an attorney general, too, but that was nothing. They didn't have a Department of Justice. The attorney general was basically just, you know, like the prosecutor of federal law. Anyway, and there wasn't much. I mean, they could only do so much. And so when Hamilton was appointed and took the seat of the Treasury, the first thing he did wasn't organizing his department. The first thing he did was he organized the Secretary of State's department. Why do you think he did that? Ah, because he marginalized the Secretary of State's role and he aggrandized the Treasury Department's role in foreign affairs with commerce and so forth, so that the Secretary of State was more, you know, less, you know, lucratively involved in treaties and those types of things, where the Treasury was actually elevated. And when Jefferson came in and he saw what was handed to him, and Washington said, well, because it took you so long, we needed to move forward, we just went ahead and did that for you. Is that okay? And, I mean, Jefferson had this respect for Washington, and so he kind of went along with it. It wasn't too long where actually Jefferson and Hamilton started beating heads, but while they were still in the beginning stages, he hadn't called him the creature yet. So the document that I have is Jefferson's account of the bargain on the Assumption Act and residence bills of 1790. You got that?
I did.
Okay. So this is where you get to come in, and this is where you'll be dominating now moving forward. So go ahead and start off with this, the debt and all of that, with this document. Go ahead.
Okay, so this is Jefferson's account of the bargain on the Assumption and Residence Bill, 1790.
Yep, that's right.
The assumption of the state debts in 1790 was a supplementary measure in Hamilton's fiscal system. Attempted in the House of Representatives, it failed. This threw Hamilton himself and a number of members into deep dismay. Going to the president one day, I met Hamilton as I approached the door. His look was somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description, even his dress uncouth and neglected. He asked to speak with me. We stood in the street near the door. He opened the subject of the assumption of the state's debts, the necessity of it in the general fiscal arrangement, and its indispensable necessity towards a preservation of the Union, and particularly of the New England states, who had made great expenditures during the war on expeditions which, though of their own undertaking, were for the common cause, that they considered the assumption of these by the Union so just and its denial so palpably injurious that they would make it a sine
quo non of continuous. In other words, a good chance of leaving the Union.
Okay.
Okay.
That as to his own part, if he had not credit enough to carry such a measure as that, he could be of no use and was determined to resign. He observed at the same time that though our particular business lay in separate departments, yet the administration and its success was a common concern, and that we should make common cause in supporting one another. He added his wish that I would interest my friends from the South, who were those most opposed to it. I answered that I had been so long absent from my country that I had lost a familiarity with its affairs, and being but lately returned, had not yet got into the train of them. That the fiscal system being out of my department, I had not yet undertaken to consider and understand it, that the assumption had struck me in an unfavorable light, but still, not having considered it sufficiently, I had not concerned in it, but that I would revolve what we had urged in my mind. It was a real fact that the eastern and southern members, South Carolina, however, was with the former, had got into the most extreme ill humor one with another. This broke out on every question with the most alarming heat. The bitterness, animosity seemed to be engendered, and though they met every day, little or nothing could be done from mutual distrust and antipathy.
And apathy, yeah.
And
okay. You're right, antipathy, you're right.
Yeah. On considering the situation of things, I thought the first step towards some conciliation of views would be to bring Mr. Madison and Colonel Hamerton to a friendly discussion on the subject. I immediately wrote to each to come and dine with me the next day, mentioning that we should be alone, that the object was to find some temperament for the present fever, and that I was persuaded that men of sound heads and honest views needed nothing more than explanation and mutual understanding to enable them to unite in some measures which might enable us to get along. They came, I opened the subject to them, acknowledged that my situation had not permitted me to understand it sufficiently, but encouraged them to consider the thing together. They did so. It ended in Mr. Madison's acquiescence in a proposition that the question should be again brought before the House by way of amendment from the Senate, that though he would not vote for it, not entirely withdraw his opposition,
yet he would. He should not be strenuous. Yeah.
Okay. Yet he should not be strenuous, but leave it to its fate.
In other words, at that point, forgive me for cutting off. You've got about a minute and a half left here, and we can stop right there. So at this point in time, Jefferson and Madison kind of, you know, worked with Hamilton at dinner, and as a matter of fact, this dinner happened to be at Madison's house. And so because Madison was more established, so he had a house and he was all by himself. He didn't have, you know, keepers or anything else. And so Madison hosted the dinner and Jefferson and Hamilton kind of showed up. And this is when the creature, what you haven't heard yet, is Hamilton proposed that the District of Columbia would be placed in Virginia, making it very convenient for the Virginianites, and therefore it gave Jefferson, what he's not saying here, an opportunity to get involved in land speculation. If he kind of knows where it's going to be, if he bought land there, it might be worth something. So anyway, he convinces Madison to be temperate, to back off, and to not be the champion against it. And Madison concedes. So at this point, we'll kind of pause and we'll just kind of pick this back up tomorrow so that we can kind of finish through this. Is that fair?
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being patient and listening to this old man ramble, you know, some history and story of how we got to where we are with this Assumption Act and moving forward. So, folks, with that, we'll come back and we're going to deal with, you know, setting the stage with the Assumption Act. We're going to actually dive into the Assumption Act at a high level, and then we're going to dive into why the Assumption Act was so essential, so that Hamilton was setting up the nation. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.